Welcome to Spinnaker Trust From the Helm. I'm Tim Melissa, Director of Portfolio Management at Spinnaker Trust. And as always, I'm joined by our Chief Investment Officer, Jessamyn Norton, and Director of Fixed Income and Alternatives, Evan Joes. In the first half of this episode, we plan on recapping the markets for 2019, while in the second half of the episode, we'll focus on our outlook for 2020. While the news flow was incredibly negative in 2019, the S&P, rose 32% on a total return basis, which was the 11th best return in the history of the S&P. While developed international markets and emerging markets were also up 22% and 18% respectively. Guys, high level, what contributed to the returns in 2019?
Yeah, so it was an interesting year in 2019. Earnings were flat. Basically 0%. And it all the return really came from expanding multiples, which were up, high 20s. But most sectors did very well. Obviously, it's important to keep in mind that this was coming off of a very bad fourth quarter in which the market was down 14%. We almost had a real bear market, 20% down from the high. So it was a bad fourth quarter. It made it up in 2019. Most of that came from or it has been attributed to the Fed pivoting. They hiked in 2018 and really turned course early on and said, hey, we're gonna probably start cutting rates here. Definitely not raising them for a long time. They did end up cutting rates three times, which some argue might have been too much, but they wanted to do it. It seems to have helped the economy. We've seen a little bit of a comeback in housing late in the year in 2019. The consumer stayed very strong throughout. And really, it was only manufacturing that has remained depressed. So,
yeah, I just mentioned, as Evan said, Q4 of 2018 was not a historic drawdown, but it was pretty close. It was down 14% in the month of December. So, it's rather arbitrary to talk about a year as January through December. If we had done more of a rolling 12-month period, the performance we'd seen in 2019 wouldn't seem so extreme. And the other thing I'd mention is that Evan said earnings were flat we haven't finalized that number yet as we haven't had the Q4 earnings season, but expectations are that earnings will be approximately flat year over year over 2018. And it sounds surprising, but that's actually a positive. If that outcome comes to pass, that would be a positive surprise because a number of macro indicators that have guided earnings in the past, the strength of the dollar, the ISM manufacturing surveys that Evan just mentioned, would have suggested that earnings would be down more. So even though earnings growth should be about 0%, that actually makes for a positive surprise. And I'll pivot a little bit into the sectors that did well. Really, there was very little that didn't do well. When you have a year that's up 32% on a total return basis, you have to have almost every sector at least participating, mm-hmm. And we did have that. I believe that every sector of the 11 sectors was up at least 20% except for energy, which I think was only up about 12%. And the blockbuster was, of course, tech, which makes up a very hefty part of the S&P 500, which was up nearly 50%, which is just crazy. In stocks like Apple was up more than 70% for the year. Microsoft had similar performance. And these stocks are important because they're just simply so large. They're a very, very big part of the index. So the negative news flow last year was relentless in every way. And at the beginning of 2019, things were a little bit scary. So Eben had mentioned the strength of the consumer, which is absolutely true. But we saw retail sales softening. We learned of that in January and February of 2019, coming off of the holiday period, which is a little scary. And housing actually had a very bad month in January and February. So while the market rose a lot, I think the economic data was certainly touch and go. And so it was a really unusual year. The news on all fronts, not just economic, but of course impeachment, China trade, things of that nature were all pretty much universally negative. And nevertheless, we had some incredible returns.
Yeah. As a lot of these economic indicators ticked down throughout the year, I think a lot of investors were looking for something to come out of the jobs market, and jobs really held up. Mm-hmm. Over the last 2 years, they have been trending down, which is typical of a late cycle economy, but they did hold up, and we haven't seen a spike in claims. The unemployment rate is at a record low. So the U.S. consumer is definitely backing up this economy.
Yeah. Jobs is the most critical part of this entire puzzle, if you will. And we're watching those weekly unemployment claims like a hawk. They are up on a year-on-year basis, about 5 or 6% on a rolling four-week basis, which is the proper way that we should view them, because they're, if you just look at every 1 week, there are a number of spikes. So let's hope we stay at approximately that level and don't go much higher. But that's something to watch.
You mentioned energy stocks underperforming once again. Why is there still this dislocation between the equities and the prices of energy? I mean, energy prices are up 30% in a year.
Yeah. So when Tim mentions that energy prices were up, he's talking about WTI or Brent crude, which are the way that oil prices are quoted. Brent is an international price and WTI is a U.S. price. But nevertheless, they were up. They had a good year. And energy stocks, while up about 12%, dramatically trailed that amount and have been for years. So the energy sector has been a conundrum for everybody. I think value investors have been very involved over the years to their detriment. And growth investors are just, I would imagine, are just talking about energy being a dinosaur and that, you know, we'll be 100% green across the world 10 years from now. The truth is, of course, somewhere in the middle of that. So I don't have the explanation. I think I had been trying to come up with it for years. I don't have the explanation. We are overweight energy today, but that's a relatively recent thing. We were neutral for the majority of 2019. And I think when your fundamental analysis is not working for years on end and you can't figure out why it's not, the sector is not doing what you think it would do, I think you have to wait until you have technical confirmation. So when using technical analysis to get involved. And while we don't have technical confirmation today, we're pretty damn close. So who knows, maybe if value is coming back and there's increased tension in the Middle East, who knows, maybe 2020 will finally be the year of energy, we'll see. Some fun facts out there to support the energy sector are that Apple, the market cap of Apple, is now bigger than the entire energy sector in the S&P 500. We all love our phones, but I think we all love to drive too. So, and as someone who follows energy really closely and knows the big stocks that we all know and love, Exxon, Chevron, the shale players, the energy sector is now yielding considerably more than the utilities, staples, or REIT sectors. And those have been dividend proxies for a long time. And the energy sector is yielding a lot more. And it's safe. You know, there's only one stock with a hefty dividend in the energy index that I think might have trouble meeting that dividend requirement over the years. The rest we do fundamental analysis on, and we're not worried one iota. So I personally believe that energy is a big value opportunity, but I've believed that for several years. So we'll see. Maybe 2020 will be my year. But there are a lot of skeptics out there. I think if you are 35 and under, you think these companies are dinosaurs and, you know, bad for the environment. And Tesla is now the largest auto company that's ever existed, bigger than GM or Ford have ever been in terms of market cap. Now, everybody knows the number of fulfillment, so the number of autos they're actually selling pales in comparison to those two companies. But it's a concept and technology and a really charismatic leader that have gotten Tesla to where it is. You know, are we all going to be driving electric vehicles 10 years from now? I don't know. But we certainly aren't going to be in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And energy is used for a lot more. Jet fuel, heating your home, you know, it's, I wouldn't count it out yet.
Yeah, those companies get a lot of press, and it's always, you know, top of mind for a lot of people. But, you know, energy is a global market, and there are there's countries out there that are a long way from using electric vehicles or having access to them. Yeah. So,
and frankly, the U.S. is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, we don't have the infrastructure, and we probably won't in 5 years. We very well could in 10 years. 10 years is a long investment horizon.
So far we focused on the equity markets in 2019. Eben, do you want to give a recap on the fixed income markets, how they performed?
Yeah, sure. So the ag was up about 9%. That's like a broad market index for the fixed income markets, high quality. And really that was focused on fears around deflation, globally, really. In Europe, you have negative rates. Japan, you have negative rates. In the U.S., we saw rates come down. The Fed started to lower rates. And there was a real fear of deflation. I mean, the 10-year break-even inflation rate now is at 1.7%. That means investors aren't expecting inflation to be beyond that over a 10-year period. And here we are with unemployment at record lows. The Fed is very accommodative. So you can see the market does not think inflation is going to happen anytime soon. And that really drove fixed income markets. So most of that return came on the duration side. As rates go down, bonds go up. So again, and if you were in high yield, you know, you kind of got through another year of where you were able to pick up that carry.
Mm-hmm. No premium, credit events.
No credit events. No. Yeah, which, you know, people keep calling for this credit event where, you know, all the triple Bs are going to fall into high yield and it's going to be this massive event. And that may well come true. But, and, you know, people have been jumping ship from the senior loans, the high yield, because you don't know when that's going to happen. Usually when it happens very quickly. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to be tactical there. But if you stayed put, you got another year of that carry. Mm-hmm.
Eben, I believe that a 9% return from the Barclays Ag is a pretty healthy return. It's not even close to the average of what that type of index returns. Is that right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, it's yielding a little over 2%. So that gives you an idea. You know, that's a very low rate. I mean, mm-hmm. you can almost sit in a money market fund right now and get, you know, a little under 2. So mm-hmm. why take that duration risk? Well, it just goes to show you how worried investors are about the world and about the possibility of deflation, at least, you know, here in the U.S., but, mm-hmm. but globally.
And I'll just make one statement. We've touched upon a few asset classes, but if you were in our diversified portfolios or any diversified portfolio, frankly, and I should mention that in our liquid alternative sleeve, we own gold, which had a very strong year as well. So, you know, it wasn't unusual for us to see a client total portfolio that was up 15, 16, 17% for the year. Mm-hmm. And that's just incredible. And in equities, we've talked a lot about it, but that bond return was extraordinary. And the gold was great as well.
Yeah, the gold, just touching on that really quickly, yeah. You know, gold moves inversely to real rates. So again, worries about deflation, global growth coming down, real rates came down, gold went up. You've also had, you know, when you have a lot of, when you have an economy that's bottoming, you do get this data that comes out, and it can be scary. And gold is good to have in your portfolio in a late cycle like this, mm-hmm. Because it's a great hedge against those kinds of things. Those
also, events. A safe haven with all the geopolitical issues that have happened and are happening and currently.
Absolutely. Yeah, we've seen it already into 2020, producing a pretty decent return on mm-hmm. what's happening in Iran.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was the perfect confluence of events in 2019 for gold. I think our expectations for that asset class are a little more muted for 2020, but given the late cycle stance of where we are, I feel like it's a reasonable thing to hold in liquid alternatives. You know, in the early and mid-cycle part of the business cycle, you want to be in something that has some beta to the S&P 500 or some equity-like characteristics. I think as you move through the business cycle, you want the opposite of that. And that's what we were looking for when we put that in the portfolio about 1 year ago.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you guys both mentioned 2020. Let's go there and talk about our outlook. First, let's focus on the equity markets. What is our outlook, both U.S. and internationally?
You know, we're broadly looking for you know, a Goldilocks environment, which, you know, not too hot, not too cold, a return to mediocre growth of around 2%, you know, which should be a good environment for equities. The Fed has really no intention of raising rates anytime soon. They've been scared off of that path. If anything, they'll probably lower rates before they would mm-hmm. raise rates if we don't bottom quickly and get some kind of return to growth. So it should be a good year for equities. You're probably not going to get much out of the multiple this year in the U.S. just based on the expansion of last year. But broadly, analysts are expecting earnings to be up, you know, in the 5% range, mm-hmm. Which seems reasonable when you're lapping a year where we're expecting flat.
Yeah. Flat and just to add some detail there, when we're trying to predict earnings for the U.S. as generalists as we are. Mm-hmm. We also look at stocks, but we certainly don't cover them all. We're looking at things like, how is the dollar trending? You know, the ISM services and manufacturing, where are they trending? Are they bottoming? Is the rate of change higher or lower? So we're trying to come to a conclusion based on factors like that. And I think we're in the camp that the manufacturing and the services sectors, it appears that services have definitely bottomed all over the world. Manufacturing appears to be in a bottoming process in the U.S. and in Europe, and it appears to have bottomed outside of those two major regions. But we're in the so bad it's good camp of ISM readings now. So yeah, I think 5% growth is a reasonable assumption. You know, last year, or I'm speaking about 2019, we don't know the final outcome. We believe earnings will be about flat. It's worth noting that about 1.5% of that comes from share buybacks. So if you took that out of the equation, you'd be negative. And we do believe that share buybacks are slowing, but still robust enough to make a difference. So yeah, I think that 5 to 7% is what's going to come to pass.
So internationally, are we favoring developed markets or emerging markets?
Yeah. So the rule of thumb is that if you believe that the manufacturing and services surveys are indeed bottoming and global growth is picking up, that generally international markets, both developed and emerging, will outperform the U.S. So if we are in that camp, then it's reasonable to assume that both of those markets, developed and emerging, will do better than the U.S. Certainly, they're a little further along in the bottoming process. You know, personally, I favor emerging markets. For all of this to work, you need the dollar to start to roll over. Technically, it has rolled over, so we have reason to believe that can continue, and that should benefit emerging markets broadly. So I believe that that will continue to happen, although there's a lot of room for improvement in Europe and Japan as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Eben, let's focus on our fixed income outlook for 2020. What are our thoughts? Can rates remain this low? And what really could cause a change in rates?
Yeah, so rates can absolutely remain this low. But I wouldn't expect the kind of return out of fixed income that we got last year. It's probably going to be much lower. As I said, the yield is very low. And even if we return to growth, you know, around 2%, the 10-year U.S. Treasury is unlikely to go above like a 2-2.5 range unless we get a big spike in inflation. And, you know, where is that going to come from? You know, maybe energy, you know, with what's going on in Iran. But actually, if you get a big spike in energy, you might get the opposite effect with rates going down because of that, what effect that might have on growth.
Mm-hmm. And so, markets might sell
and
off
markets
broadly.
Might sell off. Right. Yeah. And of course, then people are going to buy fixed income. So I don't see rates going up that much from here. Probably going to trade in a range in the U.S. And so it's probably going to be a lower return year.
And you briefly mentioned inflation and energy. Any other factors that could cause inflation to go up?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge question. I mean, I think going into 2020, inflation is something people are thinking about again. It's hard not to when you have unemployment at record lows. You have the Fed being so accommodative. It's like, where's the inflation? I mean, they want to see some inflation. They've already said they're going to let it run hot. But where's it going to come from? You know, it can come from the cost side or it can come from the demand side. We've seen wage inflation get a little bit above 3%, but, you know, gains in productivity are holding that down a little bit. And so I don't think there's a huge jump in inflation this year. I think it moves up. I think the Fed lets it move up. We're already at 1, you know, just under 2. That's a good place to be for the economy. So I don't know if Jessamyn, you have anything to add on?
No, I broadly agree. I think it will be better than it has been over better isn't the right word. It'll be higher. It'll be higher than it has been over the last few years, but it certainly won't be high in an absolute sense. And we've heard from the Fed. I mean, they've basically told us they want it to run hot, which means they want it to be above 2 for an extended amount of time. And I don't think that 2020 is a year where it's above 2 for an extended amount of time. You know, longer term, thinking about inflation, you know, there are all sorts of theories out there. The Larry Summers theory. I mean, the fact is that the world is old and getting older. Japan is incredibly old. I'm sure all of our listeners know this. Europe is following in its path. The Chinese population age peaks this year and then falls down rapidly because of the one-child policy that started back in the 70s. So when you have a graying, if you will, of the world, that means that fewer people are working and Generation X is much smaller. And so you have the recipe for continued modest deflation. It doesn't mean that certain years can't come along and inflation could be higher. But I think that is the overwhelming background that we have to view the next decade over. Now, when millennials have succeeded Generation X and Generation X is retiring, we could be back in the opposite position where inflation is strong again. But that won't be for 10, 15 years. So that's the background and the long-term secular view. with that said, inflation has been very low for a long time, and you know, it certainly could be a little bit higher.
And our investment team at Spinnaker, we've been talking a lot broadly about commodities. We touched base on energy a little bit. What are our thoughts on the metal space in agriculture?
Yeah, agriculture is an interesting one. It's basically been in a bottoming process for 5 to 10 years.
Is that a bottoming process or just
well, it hasn't started to move up, so I'm going to say it's continuing to just bottom, find its bottom. Yeah. And, you know, it's agriculture is based on global supply and demand. It's very hard to predict because a lot of the disruption can be caused by weather events, obviously, which nobody can predict weather or how that's going to play out. Obviously, the trade war has had some effect on some agriculture coming out of the U.S., between the U.S. and China. And if there were to be a trade deal, you'd probably see a little bit of a boost to ag prices. But ag is very, very hard to call. And if you've invested in that space over the past decade, I'm afraid you've probably been disappointed with the return you've gotten.
The problem with ag relative to other traditional commodity groups is that, you know, with copper, for example, we know the CapEx plans and we know it takes 3 to 5 years to build a new facility. So the supply is known. And of course, things may slow down, you may lose funding, but approximately the supply is known. With ag, it's a one-year cycle. And the supply is plantings. And those plantings, you don't have much of an outlook. And so it is really tricky. You know, ag was the rage 10 years ago. And I think, you know, I'm not sure, I don't remember precisely why, but I don't think the ag world was so global back then. And we were starting to use more ethanol. Everyone remember that. And so that was a big driver. And those days are behind us. I will say that if there's anything that's been left for dead over the last decade, it's ag. You know, check out the DBA ETF, which is probably the most pure play way to do it. Just dead. Talk about, I don't know. I don't know if bottoming again is the right word. Just bottomed. And, you know, when no one's paying attention, no one is bullish, those are the times to at least do some work. It doesn't mean that, that we'll be off to the races, but it's time to pay attention.
So we mentioned a Goldilocks environment from, you know, our initial thoughts on the outlook. What are some of the risks heading into 2020? Is it geopolitical? Is it the election? Is it the trade deal doesn't go through? What do we think?
Yeah, those are all risks.
All of the above.
All of the above, yeah. Certainly, I mean, we're in the midst of a, you know, escalation in the Middle East with Iran. You know, war is not good, obviously, for equity markets. We have the presidential election this year, which is going to be probably the most contested.
And the nomination process. You know, we really start to get some more information about what the who the Democratic nominee will be, starting really in February and then accelerating through the spring.
Yeah. And if, you know, if the Democratic nominee is you know, somebody who's farther left and they're making progress and people think they might beat Trump, that's huge for markets. I mean, you can see a rollback of some of the tax cuts. You could see a return of harsher regulations. So it will definitely affect the markets.
And I will mention that the market definitely, should there be, well, the Democratic nominee, obviously there will be one, and the market absolutely prefers a moderate Democrat to an Elizabeth Warren and a Bernie Sanders. That pair is seen as being unequivocally negative for markets. So on the flip side, if Biden is nominated or Klobuchar or someone out of left field, that could actually be a relative positive. Byron Wien is this famous economist who works for Blackstone now, who put out his 2020 predictions, and they're followed pretty closely. So I was looking at them last night, and one of them is that the Democrats take the Senate and the House, which is pretty counter-consensus, no matter what the outcome of the presidential election is. So we'll see.
Interesting.
Our own Susan Collins has a very difficult race ahead of her, and so there, you know, we may see some flip there. And it depends on when this impeachment hearing goes through and what kind of new information comes out of that and how the votes are cast. I would also add other risks that are more traditional. And, you know, Eben had talked about jobs earlier. This whole cycle is, at times, has felt like it was hanging on a precipice of a really healthy consumer. And I can't understate how healthy the U.S. consumer is today. The savings rate is incredibly high. The debt servicing rate, so, and that's just how much, what percentage of your total income is spent on servicing debt, is at all-time lows. The consumer is in good shape. And we are guessing that that consumer learned from the financial crisis in 08 and 09 and having been over leveraged. But if jobs don't hold up, if we see a spike in unemployment claims, generally that only goes in one direction. It's rare to see a spike and then have it come back down. So everything's off if we see a spike in unemployment claims and that starts to accelerate. And some of the more bearish strategists out there believe that will happen because U.S. companies have been less profitable for some time, not just the S&P 500 companies that we talk about, but there's a measure called the NIPA measure where we can see all companies, the profitability of all companies via tax reporting, and that has been heading south for several years now. So if companies believe that their earnings are not improving and their margins are not improving, and if the next step is to start to lay people off or certainly to curtail hiring, then everything is off. So if there's anything to watch, that would be it. That's the biggest risk as we see it, though there are many risks, of course.
From an asset allocation perspective, are we still holding cash in our equity buckets at Spinnaker? And is there any thought to maybe put that back to work?
Yeah, yeah. So to refresh people, we entered 2019 with cash that we don't normally hold in the equity buckets of our portfolios. Not there's one model where we didn't have it, but for the most part. And we had a program that we were following very closely to help us decide when to raise that number, put it back in, what have you. And I think we mentioned that the economic data that we follow very closely was poor last year and worsening. And under our program, we kept that cash on. What was unusual last year is that the market didn't care. It looked right through it. And I think the tone that we have today and what we'd mentioned earlier is that we believe that it's bottoming and starting to improve. So intellectually, you would say, well, it's time to put that back to work. And we have started to. So our international equity bucket, we invested that cash 2 or 3 months ago thesis that the international cycles were different and earlier than the U.S. cycle. And so we did invest that. In one of our single stock portfolios, we have invested half of that cash position and are actively looking to invest the other half. So the one remaining bucket is our big ETF U.S. allocation. Mm-hmm. And we're holding on. I will say that going into 2020, we do believe things are bottoming and that the economic scenario will pick up. However, the sentiment indicators that we follow, and we follow a lot of them, from retail investors to hedge fund investors, CTAs, flows, quantitative, we're looking at every source we possibly can. And for those who just want a quick and easy way to assess that, you can look at the CNN Greed and Fear Index. Just Google it. It's in the 95 range today, I believe, after having been at the level of 10 at this time last year. So there's a lot of optimism, a lot of flow, and investors are overly optimistic. And generally, that translates into some equity market weakness over 1 to 2 months. So perhaps we're splitting hairs here, mm-hmm. trying to get too cute. But I do believe that there could be some very temporary and muted softness over the next several weeks, call it. And then I think we'd be actively looking to get involved again.
Is there any opportunity, do you think, to add to international from our U.S. positioning, be a little bit more overweight international?
We haven't discussed this as a group. I think it depends on your time horizon. If your horizon is 1 year, sure. I think you could do that. I think that would be justified, and we could certainly consider it. Over the longer term, and I mean 3 to 5 years probably, I just look at the fundamentals of the European and Japanese economies, and I am not excited. You know, I think emerging markets is the place to be for a number of reasons. And we already have a considerable overweight right there. We could add to that, certainly. So I think it depends on your time horizon. But for 1 year, I think you could make that case. For the longer term, perhaps not.
So we covered a lot of things there. You know, we went through almost every asset class and gave you our views on 2020. We don't expect the same kind of returns that we got in 2019, but we are expecting, you know, low single digit returns in the U.S. And with an accommodative Fed and certainly fiscal stimulus happening globally, we think it could be, you know, an okay year.
Mm-hmm. And what Evans just said, which is what we believe, is really it's not a contrarian thing. That's what every strategist is saying. You know, clearly the really contrarian things are that we're just at the beginning of some kind of market melt up. You know, if we had 2 years of 30% returns, that would be nuts. It's happened before. coming out of recessions mostly, but that could happen. Or, you know, there are some strategists out there, they are few and far between, who believe that we'll see recession in the first half of 2020. So it feels like a very binary outcome, and we're playing in the middle, which isn't terribly exciting, but that's what we think for 2020.
So thank you again for listening to this episode of Spinnaker Trust From the Helm. If you haven't already, please subscribe to our podcast, give us a 5-star rating, and follow us on LinkedIn. Or to learn more about Spinnaker, check us out at spinnakertrust.com. Enjoy the winter, stay warm, and we'll talk to you soon.